Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Occasionalists. Matt Pagel here, once again flying the ship solo as we press on through our fourth and final week of The Occasionalists Daily. And we are talking today, well, should rewind a little bit. On Monday, we talked about gambling and the situation with Shohei Ohtani. We talked about Vladimir Putin and the recent terror attack perpetrated by ISIS in Moscow. And today we are talking about privacy. Probably an interesting sort of angle, even for this topic, and the idea behind this week. Kind of an interesting turn, I think, for what we do here. But this is going to be kind of an interesting one, I think, as we cover privacy. And this was kind of spurned on by Kate Middleton and her issues, with I should say the Crown's issues with sort of dealing with her cancer and everything all the conspiracy theories that sprung up with that with the Photoshop photo and everything else. Kind of spurned on by that, and oddly enough, as I was putting this together, I kind of didn't really even focus on that as the center point. But I will talk about it a little bit. I do think this is going to be the shortest, a true minisode, I think, simply because it's not like there's a deep, rich history of privacy. I mean, there is, but there isn't. There's some stuff here that we're going to go over that will make sense, but it's not like there's, it's not like when we're talking about the history of the Russian Empire and how their government formed, there's decades and decades of stuff to go through. Obviously, I really just skimmed and got the Cliff Notes version of that for the history. Well, for this, for privacy, it's realistically even shorter without going into the details of court cases and actual laws and things. Which maybe in a different episode or honestly on a different podcast altogether, that would be something you would see. So it's the history on this one is going to be a little bit shorter. And therefore, this episode is going to be a little bit shorter, where it's a true minisode after a couple episodes that approached almost an hour in length. So true minisode this week as we dive into privacy. So let's get into what history we do have here in terms of privacy. And I'm focusing on the United States for this. But it actually, surprisingly, maybe, it only really goes back our privacy rights as U.S. citizens really only goes back, or I should say, it is only defined realistically in 1965, is when the first definition of privacy kind of comes into play here. And this is from the landmark Supreme Court case, Griswold versus Connecticut, 1965. Basically, this Supreme Court case infers that the right to privacy is actually already within the framework of the Constitution, even though it is not explicitly outlined in the Constitution, right? Like there is one of the brilliant things about the Constitution and how smart the people who wrote the Constitution were is that it's made up of it's made up of very expansive definitions, and there is enough blank space in the margins, if you will, that we can interpret it, and we can interpret it as the decades and years change one way or the other. It's very often called a living document, right? So even though we didn't outline certain privacy rights, and we, as if I was there doing it, even though the founding fathers and other people that worked to codify and ratify the Constitution, even though that wasn't explicitly put in the Constitution, Griswold versus Connecticut argues that certain rights to privacy are inherently present in the Constitution. And obviously this opens the door to more legal challenges that weren't explicitly mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. Like this is essentially this is a very, very important case because it really opens the door to a lot. So there are more legal challenges there are more legal challenges that come before the Supreme Court because, again, as the world has changed, even by 1965 versus 1765, as the world changes over the let's just say that 200-year period, there are things that are happening, there are realities that are happening, there are situations that are happening in the United States that the Founding Fathers could not have necessarily envisioned, but they did allow for legal interpretation of any kind of future event in their creation of the Constitution. So again, Griswold versus Connecticut, it also, so not only does it open up the challenges to other things that aren't explicitly in the Constitution, this is our first step towards expanding privacy rights in the United States. And it brought more cases that would further define our privacy rights in the United States. The most famous of these, and obviously more recently, the most controversial of these is Roe v. Wade, is the most famous of these privacy rights, these court cases that are the Supreme Court cases that are privacy rights centric, is essentially what Griswold versus Connecticut starts and kind of opens the door for. Like I said, there's a lot to go into there. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a law expert. If you really want to dive into Griswold versus Connecticut, there's plenty of places you go read up about it. It's funny because it's not about how you're thinking of privacy rights at all. But it involves condoms and Planned Parenthood. It is a very landmark case in the United States. Then we can fast forward a little bit here to the Privacy Act of 1974 and FERPA, also in 1974. All right, so FERPA, which is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, both these are 1974. This basically ensures that schools are handling student information properly and working with parents and students to protect their privacy. It basically, the very simplest way to think about this is that it more readily cuts in parents into the daily decisions of what schools are doing. Previously, schools had quite a bit more oversight, or I should say, maybe that's not the right way to put it. They had much more authority to do things on behalf of students without their parents' consent, or in many cases, without their parents knowing. And this basically ensures that schools have to notify parents about any kind of changes in the curriculum, any kind of punishments. They have to that kind of stuff. Basically, I think you get it. I think you get what FERPA is about. It just levels the playing field for parents, students, and the school administration, making things more transparent on the side of the schools. The Privacy Act of 1974 specifically restricts how the government can collect data and how it can disseminate said data from regular civilians, regular citizens of the United States. Pretty straightforward here, but kind of interesting. It took until 1974 to kind of limit how the government can essentially monitor its own citizens. But again, stuff that we probably weren't thinking about necessarily until we get to, at this point, past the civil rights movement, but again, it's just a different time. There was really no reason to worry about the government collecting data on you like in the 1950s, I suppose. But again, as the decades change, as things change, we need to reinterpret laws and reinterpret the Constitution to kind of determine what exactly our privacy rights even are. So that is 1974, the Privacy Act of 1974, and FERPA. There you go. Keeping that short and sweet, I don't really, again, if you're truly interested in FERPA or the Privacy Act of 1974, there is good reading all over the place you can do about it. You can Google that. Ask ChatGPT or something. But I don't really feel like it's necessary to get into great detail about any of those laws or the details of the Griswold versus Connecticut court case. I think the Cliff Notes version suffices here. But let's get into privacy as it concerns us today. I think that privacy faces two main challenges, and we'll go through them one at a time and go through the details of these one at a time. So I think the first and the most present, especially for us, in terms of like sort of a front-facing threat to our personal privacy, is obviously social media. That's where we're going to go first, right? I'm going there. Would we have to go there first? Because it's what we interact with every single day. Even if we are one of those people, an otherwise social media Luddite, who does not have an Instagram, a Facebook, or a Twitter, or anything, even those people still, in some way, shape, or form, interact with social media. You know, even if you know you might not be on any of those platforms, but if you have a smartphone, I'm sure someone has sent a video, or has sent a meme, or something that originated on Instagram, or originated on Twitter, or wherever, or Facebook, or wherever. So even by extension, those people still are being touched by social media. And certainly, like, you know, for most of us, we have one of these things. And it's not an exaggeration to say that, simply because there are billions and billions of people who are on all these social media platforms. And since most of the world's internet users, in terms of like a singular collection of the world's internet users, are in the United States, and then obviously with enclaves in various places in Europe and Asia, but like in terms of like one singular bulk of internet usage, of singular internet users, the United States makes up like the biggest singular chunk. It is not an exaggeration for me to say that probably 80% of people in the United States, maybe even 90% of the people in the United States, have some form of social media, whether or not they're active users or checking it every day, or, you know, that's not really the point. The point being is that practically everyone has some form of social media on their phone or on their computer. So we have to start there, because this is what we interact with every single day. And I think social media itself has sort of three main components to the challenge of maintaining your privacy, is the way I'll put it. And the first one is sort of our own need to participate in the social discourse, right? Like, we have this need, no matter what we say about not wanting to blend in with the crowd, or not wanting to be a part of, you know, part of a trend or something like that, or, you know, being counterculture and not wanting to be part of the mainstream pop culture. We all want to participate in the social discourse in some way, shape, or form. One of my favorite examples of this, whenever it comes time for voting anywhere in the United States, but, you know, thinking about all my friends whenever we're voting here in Ohio, you know, people put their I voted sticker or whatever on their Instagram stories or on their Facebook page. That's all great. And then there are people who I know people who mock the people who, you know, put their I voted stickers up on social media by putting their own kind of sarcastic meme or something up on social media. And despite what they think they're doing, they are not denying the discourse. They are just providing a different side to the discourse. They are participating in the social discourse by their insistence that they will not participate in the social discourse. Sorry to break that to you if you're one of those people, but you are participating in pop culture by insisting that you are not participating in pop culture, essentially. So anyway, to circle back here, there is this need that we all have to jump in feet first to what's happening, right? Maybe we even want to build our own following if you're one of those types of people. But we really struggle with, you know, this is very much an and or situation, right? You can participate in the social discourse via social media. You can try to build a following, you know, build your own little enclave of people who are interested in you. But keeping unwanted people at arm's length proves difficult. It's a very difficult thing to do all of these things at the same time. You can make your Instagram, your Twitter, your Facebook private, right? You can make all of these things private, but then that limits exactly how many people you can reach. So you might be part of the social discourse insofar as your friend group, right? Like you know, the fifth, let's just say you have 100 followers, or you follow 100 people, and that's sort of what you've limited yourself to. That's what you're limiting your the social discourse to, those 100 people. You cannot build a following, you know, based off of those 100 people. But it does keep the unwanted people out of your circle. So in order to really, what really a lot of people, the experience that a lot of people want to get out of this is to have sort of the, to see the more wide range of opinions, commentary, ideas and things, but to get, to tap into that circle, to tap in a circle that is now 10,000 big or 100,000 big, you know, 100,000 voices, a million voices, right? To tap into that circle, you have, you absolutely have to bring down some of your need for privacy. And in the case of like a social media app, literally you have to change your privacy settings to allow more people in if you want to be a part of that portion of the discourse. So there is, so I think really the biggest and first barrier to maintaining privacy is us. It's ourselves and our need to jump right into the social discourse. I think the second challenge and the second sort of fight for our privacy comes from the realization that despite your best efforts to kind of contain yourself on social media, that you are still handing over reams of data to Zuckerberg and Musk and others who have proven to be completely untrustworthy when it comes to handling our personal data. There's a reason why you get a flurry of unsolicited ads and things like that. There's a reason why these data breaches happen all the time. It's because the people who have been entrusted with controlling our personal data are not great at actually controlling it and protecting it and keeping it safe. So when you do participate in social media, you are giving over a ton, believe it or not, even if you are, you know, one of those proverbial people that has a minimum amount of interaction and friends on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it doesn't matter. Every like, every share, every repost, hashtag, comment, etc., is cataloged, it's analyzed, and it's used against you, right? This all figures into an algorithm that presents to you more ads and other accounts that might be of interest to you, especially if those accounts have come with more affiliate marketing and come with more products to sell, right? Those are the things that are going to be presented to you. Again, it doesn't even matter if you are quote unquote a private account. Is whenever you do like things on one of your 100 proverbial friends accounts, every time you repost something from someplace, it doesn't matter that your own personal settings have kind of limited exactly who can see and interact with it. The fact that you are doing it, the fact that you are making that impression, is cataloged regardless by these companies to add it to your kind of personal, if you will, algorithm and better serve you the things that you seem to be interested in. So it just doesn't matter it doesn't matter how much you're trying to avoid this. Simply by being on these platforms, you are giving them information. You are just handing it right over to them. And now kind of where the Kate Middleton of it all comes in. And she's really just sort of the latest example of this. And this is something that certainly has been ongoing since social media has become more of a force in our personal lives, right? The wall between high profile people, if you want to call them celebrities, famous people, influencers, whatever, but the wall between high profile people and regular people is absolutely the thinnest it's ever been. People who, again, we're not even talking necessarily about celebrities in the way that we used to think about them, just people who have a large following on social media are more accessible than they've ever been before. Once upon a time, you only got to see movie stars in movies. You only got to see TV stars on TV. Maybe you had a chance encounter when you were in Los Angeles or something with somebody, but that was it, right? Like that was the reality for a very, very long time. And now these people, especially certain stars, I'm just going to use I'll stick with Kate Middleton here, but for in a, I'll get back to Kate Middleton here for a second. But I'm going to go with like The Rock here as like an example, as someone who is ever present on social media, who is sharing every business update, sharing daily workouts, sharing his cheat meals, sharing the goings on of the UFL, what he's doing next in the WWE. It is full access 24/7 to The Rock. The Rock or Dwayne Johnson, depending on kind of which persona he's kind of inhabiting at that moment. If it's the UFL, then it's definitely Dwayne Johnson. If he's talking about the WWE, it's definitely The Rock. But regardless, it is unfettered access to two very distinct sides of this particular celebrity. And he plays a social media game very, very well. I follow him on social media. He's a great follow. Especially his cheat day meals. My goodness, folks, you got to get in on his cheat day meals. They're fantastic. They're epic. But it does feel like more so than ever you are being invited into these people's lives. And for the most part, I think people can handle that responsibly. Like I said, I follow The Rock. I'll throw a like on something that he does that I find interesting. I've even commented on stuff like that before. But in no way, shape, or form do I feel like I'm truly one of The Rock's friends, right? Like, me and Dwayne aren't hanging out. We're not buddies. And, like, I get that. But there are other people who really ruin this social media experience because they cannot handle this reality. That despite what it feels like, despite how this famous person, whether it's someone like The Rock or whether it's someone like a Kate Middleton who is very present, who is very outwardly present, as on social media and as sort of one of the main representatives of the royal family in England, there are people that don't understand that just because they are giving us something to they're interacting with us on a level in a medium that is the same medium that we're using, it does not mean that these people are open for they're not online singing and dancing for us, right? Like, we are not seeing these people for our, I'm kind of phrasing that wrong. The people like Kate Middleton, the people like The Rock, the people, the other influencers, even people, go take many steps below that, someone with 10,000 followers, they are not online for our convenience. They are online for their convenience. And to build a brand and to maintain contact in a meaningful way that helps prop up their image and promote things that they want to promote. And we saw how the frenzy with Kate Middleton, and as it turns out, she's undergoing preventative chemotherapy, but her kind of disappearance from the public eye, her lack of presence on social media, and then obviously the poorly Photoshop photo to kind of prove that she was okay or whatever sparked all these conspiracy theories and things. And it's because there are people, like, again, I'm predisposed to not give a shit about the royals because I'm not fucking British. Who the fuck cares? But I truly don't understand why people are obsessed with them anyway. And I really don't understand why people who are not from England are obsessed with them, but neither here nor there. But because there are people that feel like Kate Middleton is there for their convenience and their pleasure, it then almost feels personal that she has been out of the public spotlight for an extended period of time, and it gives rise to these conspiracy theories, about her actually being dead or about her and William divorcing or breaking up or whatever. It gives rise to these conspiracy theories because these people cannot handle the fact that, guess what? Like us regular people, they need a break from social media as well. They need a break, or there are circumstances that are forcing them to take a break from social media or step back from that sort of spotlight. And while it is a self-imposed spotlight, it's, again, normal people understand that as easily as that spotlight is turned on, it can be turned off, and that it's not personal that it's being turned off. But there are some people, some entities out there that cannot handle this and do think that it's personal. So these three things here, that thin wall between regular people and high-profile people, and the need for certain people to have unfettered access, full-time access to these high-profile people, the realization that you're handing a lot of data over to these big companies, and in many cases individuals, to determine what they're going to do with it, and then our own need to sort of to participate in the social discourse and be involved in culture, pop culture, counterculture in some way, shape, or form. These three things kind of really make up this messy ball that that is social media and the fight for privacy on these platforms. All right, I think you can probably guess the next thing that I'm going to talk about here in terms of like the threats to our personal privacy. But I'm going to kind of go with a little bit of a I don't know, not a story, but just sort of a very, very recent history of personal devices, right? So stay with me here. At the dawn of cell phones, people were very, very concerned. The government was listening in on their conversations, right? When consumer internet became very popular, the internet's been around since the 60s. It was in use in the early 1980s, but consumer internet, the way that we think about the internet to get online and surf the web, play games and that kind of stuff, that's like late 80s, early 90s is when the consumer internet really begins to take off. You probably, if you're about my age, you probably remember those AOL discs. Young kids, ask your parents about this. But when consumer internet became more popular, people were concerned that the government was reading their emails and reading their AIM messages. Again, kids, talk to your parents about what AIM is and AIM messenger is. People are more recently have been worried that their smartphones are listening to their conversations, that the government is tapping our cell phones and tracking us and listening to our conversations. And I will say briefly here, your smartphone is definitely listening to you. In some way, shape, or form, it's listening for certain keywords, but you can shut that particular feature off. Anyway, sidebar over. People are worried their smartphones are spying on them and relaying information to government entities and listening to their conversations. These people are kind of right. However, no one is listening to you. Just let that marinate for a second, right? You are kind of, these people, the paranoid people who think that the government's listening into their phone calls, reading their emails, reading their text messages, monitoring their social media likes. You're not wrong in a very general sense. But here's the thing. They are not listening to you. There is too much to listen to. There is too much to read. There is too much for them, for the government, for whomever, to parse through to give two shits about you. Unless you happen to repeatedly visit terrorist sites, right? Message boards and forums and things that have been linked to terrorist networks. Social media accounts that are linked to ISIS or that are linked to an extremist group in the United States, a nationalist group abroad, right? If you happen to be repeatedly visiting these sites or tweeting, retweeting an ISIS account or a Proud Boys account, then they might be interested in you. If your phone number is associated with known criminal syndicates and organizations, known terrorist groups, drug cartels, individual felons, you might be a person of interest that they do want to listen to, right? The people who do domestic surveillance are far too busy trying to figure out if there's an imminent terrorist attack, if someone is going to, you know, put a bomb in a school or a building. They are way too busy trying to figure out and decode smuggler codes and things like that to determine if there's going to be a drug shipment somewhere or if there's whatever, right? There is so much for them to do and look at that they are far too busy to be worried about you and whether or not you sexted a married man or something, right? Like, there is so much data, so much information that is so much more important than what you liked on social media, than that time you had a conversation with your best friend about, you know, about a breakup or something. They don't give a shit about that. There's far too much for them to look at. Now, this is a real concept here. I'm not just trying to shame you. This is a real concept here. It's called security through obscurity. And the idea is that there is so much data and so much information being produced and consumed on a daily basis that simply the volume of stuff that someone would have to look through will obscure any individual, right? Except for the individuals that they're looking for. You know, again, if someone has links to a terrorist network, if someone has repeatedly visited a website that is a known portal for terrorist messaging and activity, you know, they'll find that IP address. Being government entities and law enforcement entities of all varieties, they will flag those to kind of follow the data trail that a particular IP address or I can't remember what the phone equivalent IME number or something. Your phone has a similar tracking number associated with it the same way your computer does. And they'll flag those particular numbers to see what else is being produced in the data stream through them. But if you are a regular person, you will just sort of like a drop of water in the ocean, right? Like you will just sort of disappear it amongst everything else. Again, this is called security through obscurity. I mean, there is, I shit you not. So there is, here's how much data is produced and consumed every single day. 2.5 quintillion bytes of data per day. That is 2.5 billion gigabytes, literally enough to fill 125,000 DVDs every single day with new information. That's literally if the world was producing 125 full feature movies every single day, that's how much information is produced and consumed by us. There is so much data, it is impossible to meaningfully search it, organize it, cut through, find certain things. It is impossible. You have, in general, and this is where I'm going with this one, in general, you have security through obscurity. But do you know who can look through 2.5 quintillion bytes of data every day? Much, much faster than some analyst sitting at a desk at the FBI. You know who can do this much faster? Skynet. Skynet can do it much faster. Artificial intelligence, not Skynet, I'm kidding. Artificial intelligence can do this much faster. And this is the emerging threat to our privacy. The privacy that we were kind of assured simply by the sheer volume of information that we produce and consume every day. AI can more quickly find keywords in social media posts, podcasts, emails, phone calls, etc. I don't want to get bogged down into artificial intelligence too much, but the way it sort of learns and the way it creates its own simulations to become more efficient. And once it is sort of let loose in a data set, it becomes more efficient over time. It can more quickly, so it's not just like it's not just a buzzsaw. It's a buzzsaw that learns how to cut faster and faster each and every time given new data sets, because it actually learns from one data set to the next. So it can not only more quickly find these keywords or find certain red flags in the data stream. It figures out how to find them even faster than it did before. And while those people who do conduct surveillance of persons of interest, people who have been linked to terrorist networks or people who have been in certain message rooms, message boards, trying to find certain objects and things like that are illegal, while they are turning the AI loose on those people to make this sort of surveillance and targeting red flags easier, it also just becomes much easier for them to, well, while we're looking at these people, we can unleash these AI, these learning networks and AI on regular people to see if there are any potential red flags, irregularities, anything in the data stream that would signal, give us more reason to look at somebody. So where previously, and let me be clear here, if people aren't familiar really with the ins and outs in AI, not that I am an expert, but I do work in the field that I work in. I do work every day with AI, with ones that are essentially on the same level as your ChatGPT, your Claude's, Bard, Gemini, things like that. So we're not talking about hyper advanced AI. We're talking about like the ones that are available to consumers are essentially what I'm working with every day. However, the ones that are being used for, you know, for counterterrorism, the ones that are being used for that kind of data organization and searching and flagging, they are not using Bard or Claude for that. They're using AI from Microsoft and Anthropic and all the various companies that are actually not connected to the internet because of the inherent security risk that these AI pose if they were to ever actually be connected to the internet in a meaningful way. Not to say that it's not like we're not talking about a Skynet situation, but we are talking about AI that are so much more polished and advanced than what we deal with every day. These are the AI that are discovering new chemical compounds, cleaning up pictures of black holes, cutting through decades of NASA data to find potential black holes and other anomaly. These are the ones that are going through and trying to discover new ways to create energy, to solve very complex problems, right? These things are completely different animals from what you and I might use to ask a question or something like that. These are things that are very purposely kept siloed off from larger networks because, again, they do pose a complete and total security risk if they were to put themselves in the larger internet, the larger data stream, the larger network of the world that we all sit on. So these AI, it's not like, you know, Claude would have a tough time cutting through all the data that we produce in a day. But, I think one of the ones that's behind closed doors is like Code 02 Da Vinci would have zero problem finding me essentially, or finding you, and then cutting through an entire year's worth of our data in a matter of moments. And finding out all of the places that we've been, the people that we've talked to, the websites that we visited, the words that we've said in a phone call, whatever. It would find all of that in a matter of moments. And so as AI becomes more advanced, as it learns better from these large data sets that it's allowed to sort of comb through, it's going to become more efficient at breaking this previous sort of guarantee of privacy that we had, this security through obscurity. And it is, it's kind of a frightening thought, but again, pretty much as long as you're not doing things online that would inherently make you a sketchy person, it's unlikely that anything, you know, whatever learning network the FBI is essentially pumping all their information into, unless you're already kind of a sketchy person that they'd be looking at anyway, it's unlikely that you would suddenly pop up on some kind of FBI database or something simply because you happen to watch a video of, just thinking like recent, just the Crocus City Hall terrorist attack, just because you happen to watch a video from ISIS or concerning ISIS and their terrorist activities, unlikely that you would come up as a red flag. But if you, over a period of time, let's just say over a period of a week, visited a known ISIS forum, posted to this forum, retweeted an ISIS linked Twitter account. Were on an ISIS Facebook page and said something positive about ISIS. Obviously, that would be something that would flag you. And I think the fact that I just said ISIS so many times in the course of a minute probably is going to get me flagged. But that's the kind of stuff that you have to, that's the territory you have to wander into to sort of pop up on a radar anyway. And if you're not doing this kind of stuff, then you probably don't have anything to worry about. Because again, they do not care about what you are doing on your free time with the internet, with your tablet, with your phone. They really don't give a shit. And that is it for today. Hopefully I didn't scare you off of social media, or at the very least, hopefully I didn't scare you away from this podcast. There's some real hurdles that we need to overcome, or maybe not overcome. There are some real obstacles that we need to figure out and figure out how to maneuver around when it comes to our privacy. And unfortunately, as always is the case in our modern society, technology is outpacing laws. It's also outpacing sort of the buffers that we put into place to keep ourselves safe. Hopefully that gap gets narrowed a little bit, but for now there are definitely significant obstacles when it comes to maintaining our privacy. But that is it for today. Tomorrow's episode is TBD, to be determined. I haven't decided just yet. I think I know what general direction I'm going to go in, but we'll see if I decide to go that route or not. So tomorrow's episode, TBD. However, regardless, there will be an episode tomorrow, and we will catch you on the flip side.